From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, classical magic. Here's what's happening. Well, October 1st of last year, I was on the air when we started getting reports of a shooting in Las Vegas. Turned out to be that horrible tragedy where 58 people were gunned down. It happened again last night, Thousand Oaks, California. A former Marine armed with a .45 caliber handgun with an illegal extended magazine opened fire on a packed California country music bar, killing 12 people, including a veteran sheriff sergeant nearing retirement. Authorities believe that Ian David Long eventually turned the gun on himself, but did not do it before the 28-year-old, dressed in all black, terrorized a crowd filled with college students at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California. Long's body was found in an office near the entrance of the bar. He had been a Marine. He had been in Afghanistan. And there are some that say he suffered from PTSD. Dr. Peter Breggin, our resident psychiatrist, with us. Peter, of course, obviously he was not a patient of yours, so it's difficult to analyze. But if you could tell us a little bit about the dangers of PTSD.
Everybody who goes through through those war zones has PTSD. And frankly, the greatest danger being a veteran with PTSD is how you get treated by the VA.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would load those men up with all kinds of drugs. They would give them drugs that didn't even have remote indications for being useful. They'd get them on 4 and 5 drugs. I don't know if that happened to him. What we hear is that he didn't want treatment. That may mean that he had had some bad treatment. So that's a blank right now. What we do know is that, once again, my profession of mental health, of psychiatry, I'm a psychiatrist, failed, because in April, a neighbor's complaining about how angrily he was shouting at his mother, called
right.
the police, and they sent mental health people in. And that's just earlier this year, and they decided that he was not dangerous, and they could not commit him or certify him under the law. So the reliance on psychiatry is not working. We're going to have to find other ways than funding more psychiatry. And I think we're reaching the point now that we're really in a sort of this national trauma, as my wife called it, Ginger, when we were talking tonight. She said it's a national slow rolling trauma, and we need some sort of cultural shift, George. We need people from the left and the right. We need the various religious groups. We need the universities to really call a halt to violence of all kinds, and to start to talk of people treating each other in a whole different way. Because we're really in a national situation now where we have all of this violence.
And what is it about people, Peter, where they will kill people and then they'll take their own life? Why don't they just do that first? You know, I don't advocate suicide for anybody, but I mean, if you're going to kill yourself before you kill 12 people with you.
Well, almost every one of these folks is suffering from deep feelings of shame and humiliation. They feel really that they have been injured by other human beings. And usually it's in the family. This man is still living with his mother on and off, and was expressing a lot of violence and rage toward her. And their motivations have to do mostly not with wanting to die, but with wanting to get even. Wanting to display power.
See, and we don't know. He might have had a girlfriend at that club, an ex-girlfriend. Who knows? Nobody knows the motive yet.
No, but we do know he was actually going to the club with friends.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? He's taking it out on the people at the club. And the people at the club are younger than him, by and large. They're college-age students.
That's right.
He's 28 years old. Maybe there was an element of jealousy and envy. But these are not people who are motivated to injure themselves primarily. That's people who are depressed, end up, you know, wanting primarily to injure themselves. I mean, someone like him, he's full of rage and anger and wants to get even, wants to hurt other people. And we really need to be figuring out how we're going to bring our nation together to discourage, you know.
Oh, it's crazy. Thank you again. Dr. Peter Breggin, his website, breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. It's part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. And our condolences to the family members who lost people in that tragedy. A new Japanese study has found that suicide rates among middle-aged male office workers often peak on Monday mornings. The study, conducted by researchers in Tokyo and Osaka University, claims to be the first of its kind to explore suicide rates based on timings in Japan. You know, just in Japan, we had a story about suicides of young children. The country has long struggled with one of the world's highest suicide rates and a notorious culture of overworking, but they say it peaks suicides for middle-aged office workers, males, on Monday mornings. Jeez. Charges were filed Thursday against the captain of a Missouri duck boat that sank in severe weather in July and killed 17 people, including 9 members of the same family. Women who smoke have diabetes or high blood pressure increase their risk of a heart attack more than men faced with the same risks, according to a recent study. Just remember that. Cigarette smoking is losing popularity in the United States, where health officials announced just 14% of the population now smokes. That's the lowest level ever recorded in the United States. The Federal Reserve held interest rates steady on Thursday, but remained on track to keep gradually tightening borrowing costs as it pointed to a healthy economy that was marred only by a dip in the growth of business investment. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Michael Mish Shedlock. Mish, your take on the economy for this quarter. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, that was an interesting FOMC today. They said that the economy continued to strengthen. They said economic activity was rising at a strong rate. They said jobs gains was strong. And they said household spending continued to grow strongly. You hit the one point. But even on that, it was business fixed investment moderated from a rapid pace. If I was to look at these headlines in isolation, I would be saying, well, they hiked for sure, but they didn't. They keep hiking at this glacial pace. Now, even though it's been a glacial pace, it's actually been stronger than what I thought was going to happen. Because I think the economy appears to be a lot stronger than it looks. And earlier this week, we had the JOLTS survey. That's the jobs openings and layoffs and turnovers. And it says that there's 7 million people, 7 million openings. George, I just don't buy these numbers. If there really was 7 million openings, for jobs, wages would be soaring out of sight due to competition. So there's some things going on here. I think that the Fed sees one of them is housing. Housing is clearly on a slowdown 6 of the last 7 months. I think they're trying to get in as many rate hikes as they can so that they have room to cut for the next recession.
And that will happen. Thanks, Mish. Appreciate it. This weekend, 3 enormous asteroids will make a very close approach to Earth, according to NASA. The asteroids, the biggest of which is predicted to measure up to 90 feet across, will whiz past the planet on November 10th. Not to worry, they say, we're not going to get hit. Up next, let's talk about brain implants and more with the expert on fuzzy logic, Bart Cusco, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Bart Cusco, back with us, professor of electrical engineering and law at the University of Southern California. He is an award-winning pioneer and author in the machine learning fields of artificial intelligence, neural networks, and fuzzy logic. He holds degrees in philosophy, economics, mathematics, electrical engineering, and law. And he holds several patents on machine learning and has published several textbooks. Bart, back on Coast to Coast. Love it when you're on the show, Bart. Welcome.
Good to be back, George.
My gosh, look at all these degrees. How long have you been in school?
I've been in school for over 50 years.
That's amazing.
Literally, continuously for 50 years.
Your very first degree was what?
I had joint degrees in philosophy and economics and was wrapping up one in mathematics, but went ahead and got it in later in a master's degree. And I got to say, George, people make fun of philosophy majors, but to me, it's the gift that keeps on giving, and I'll tell you why. When I was 18 and I was at USC as a student, actually there on a music scholarship of all things, I was interested in film composing, but I was there, I took a course on symbolic logic, and I realized, wow, I don't know what I'm talking about. Every time I utter a sentence like I am now, can I really capture that in formal logic? Well, it was great training, and it's that that ultimately led me, among many other things, to fuzzy logic.
Good for you. Do you have a favorite degree of all of them that you have?
That's hard to say, but I would pick philosophy, which is thinking about thinking. And there's no solid answers there. It's really a theory of questioning, but it's great training. And I would recommend to anybody going to college or someone going back to college to either take a course in philosophy or consider a double major in it.
I bet it
goes out of style.
I bet you would have loved to have talked to Socrates or Aristotle.
You bet. Those are my heroes.
Oh, my gosh. That would have been interesting.
And, in fact, we use something from Socrates that we call the Socratic method. We try to use it lightly. Sometimes in law school, but especially in a philosophy class, we try to tease out of the student the answer. It was Socrates' view that everybody has all the truth in them, and we try to pull that out with questions.
You've got a cyber thriller that's almost to be re-released called Nanotime.
Yes, I do.
That's going to be interesting. Maybe a movie sometime, huh?
You know, real fast, it actually began with a phone call from the great director Oliver Stone in 1994 and said, hey, you're my machine intelligence friend who writes fiction. There's a guy named Stanley Kubrick's got a movie called AI coming out. Can you give me a treatment? Well, I gave him a treatment. We became a 40-page behemoth, and we weren't able to get it made at the time in 94, but it grew into a novel. Who knows, maybe someday it will, George.
Perfect. Now, let's look at some of the technology you've been looking at, Barton. Let's start with things that are out there, brain implants, heart implants. What's going on here with technology?
First off, we have those. We have deep brain implants, usually just simple stimulators for people, say, with Parkinson's or depression or epilepsy or many other things. And we also have heart monitors that people wear. For example, what are called watchman monitors for people who have AFib and a variety of more things like that. They're safe, but they do have a wireless link usually. And what we're concerned about, George, is number one, they may not have adequate password protection. In other words, the safe devices, they have to pass a lot of FDA regulations. But it's not clear at all they can survive hackers. And the hacking frontier is only expanding in terms of these devices and many others.
It was just a story that we had earlier this week that hackers could possibly get into brain implants and control thoughts and actions of people. I mean, I found that to be an amazing story. Strange, bizarre, but really amazing.
It is amazing. It's very scary. And you look at the authors of that report. They're from Oxford University, from the Neuroscience Group and Kaspersky Labs. These are people who know what they're talking about, and we're concerned right now. There has not been, to anyone's knowledge, such a hack in the wild, as they call it, but it could surely happen, and these devices are only increasing in frequency. But as we go out, it looks increasingly like in 5 years to 10, we'll be able to boost memory without necessarily programming the content of memory. So, for example, I was talking about this in a lecture last night in my course in neurocomputing. I'm thinking, great, it'd be great to have that right now for the students, so that when you're in the middle of a lecture, you could flip the switch or increase the juice, so to speak, so that you retain more of what you hear. But by the time we get to 15 to 20 years out, we should be able to at least impart implant content. And once that stops, there's no stopping it, George.
Yeah, let's talk about brain implants for a second here, Bart. What are they used for now? What are they doing with them?
Right now, they're often used to help, like say, patients with tremors, with Parkinson's, with epilepsy. It's kind of unclear why they work. I certainly don't know all the medical facts of that, but physicians have looked at this and been able to improve the response of patients, for example, with chronic pain sometimes,
by stimulating parts of the brain. The key thing to remember about the brain, it is an electrical device.
Yes.
An odd thing.
It's wired.
It is massively wired. In fact, most of what's in the brain are just wires. And because of that, I mean, how does it actually work? It works through, in some sense, salt. We come out of the ocean, so it's not surprising that the ions and sodium and chloride and salt and other things like that, calcium, they flow through the meat, about 1 million ions per second. And that governs everything in our body. When you wiggle your big toe, you've got a big wired link from the brain to the big toe and back. An awful lot of neural computing is going on there, but it's a completely electrical process. And the signal fades and has to be pumped up. So it's not surprising that by stimulating parts of the brain, you can get different effects. Maybe in general negative, but they have found some definite positive benefits of doing this.
Now, whereabouts in the brain do they implant these things? All over?
Many places, sometimes in cortex. In the more recent cases, is directly into the memory unit, which is the hippocampus. That's kind of in the midbrain, what used to be called the limbic system, kind of tied to emotions, right next to the amygdala and places like that. I think there's no real limit to it, but a lot of the current advances, and one of the biggest ones that just came down, are in the hippocampus, the seat of memory, at least a key seat of memory in the brain.
That's dramatic. Will there ever be a time where they implant chips in you and then you can download information? And let's say you want to learn how to speak fluent Spanish, for example, and you don't know how to speak it at all. Might you be able to with the right chip in the right spot of the brain?
Oh, I think that's coming and will put people like me out of business as a teacher. On the other hand, when you unplug the chip, you won't remember
a thing.
How to speak Spanish or how to do that. But I might say, George, one of my colleagues at USC, Professor Ted Berger, and the biochemistry and the biomedical department just pulled off a major feat with many colleagues at other, including the other USC, University of South Carolina. And this is a DARPA-funded study. It just came out in the Journal of Neurocomputing. And they were able, for the first time that I'm aware of in history, to write into a brain. In other words, they took epileptic patients who already had electrodes into the brain, into the hippocampus. And while they were showing them patterns, images, to test their ability to recall them later with memory, the mathematical model they had, the, if you like, the AI model, the smart model, was running offline faster than the flesh was thinking, so to speak. They were able to identify the regions to enhance the memory at a given time. And when it was all done, they boosted the memory by 37%.
Now, that's incredible.
That's never been done before. And it's a first cut, it's a proof of principle study, but it's a real breakthrough. Again, what it's not doing is taking, as you said, Spanish and coding that in there, but it's looking at the patterns as you learn Spanish in different parts of the brain, in this case something called CA1 and hippocampus, which is kind of a worm-like structure inside your center of your brain, and figuring out through mathematical models, basically probability models, something we call a Volterra model, where that was and where it was going to be, and reinforce it with the existing stimulator.
Now, outside of hacking, which we'll get into in a second here with you, what's the downside? Is there any downside to any of this kind of technology?
There's always downsides. One of them is, I think, the moral hazard, as you kind of suggested there, the over-reliance. Like, for example, George, has your ability to do numbers in your head improved? I doubt it. The ability of students to read text in books, I think, is diminished. As people
Right. For example, if you go through a fast food place, Bart, and they have to make change out of their heads, they can't do it.
We've lost that skill, and we're all guilty of that. So you've got to ask, if this has become such a crutch, what will it be like? I got to say, George, I'm not used to seeing everyone on campus at USC walking around just looking at this little rectangle they're holding in their hand. In the last 2 or 3 years, you know, and you just want to shout to folks, hey, the real world is out there, not watching it on the handheld thing, which is really a lot to do with marketing people in Silicon Valley, and it's a long way from the way we want it. But you've got to ask what kind of skills are being lost, and one of those is the ability, I think, to focus, to concentrate long-term. And that's why I know it's a very retro thing to say, George, but I strongly recommend reading books, not just mine, but
absolutely.
Anybody. Just the sheer act of reading is like a prolonged meditation. It's good for the brain.
I mean, the little rectangle is great for instant communications and sending a quick email and things like that. But we have lost something. I fly quite a bit, Bart, and you sit at the airport and just look at the rows of people sitting down 9 out of 10 of them are holding their smartphones doing something with it. I mean, it's amazing.
The guy is charging his, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
We don't talk as much, and there's people are in their own world. You hear people walking by talking loudly. People don't engage as much. And you've got to wonder where that's headed.
Absolutely. Stay with us, Bart. We'll come back and talk more about this. Fuzzy logic expert. His books, by the way, Fuzzy Future, Noise, Heaven in a Chip, and so much more. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, back with Bart Costco. Bart, brain implants are being put into brains with people who have had epilepsy and epileptic seizures. Is it working for them?
My understanding is that it does, at least more often than not. Otherwise, it wouldn't be done. And that's subject, George, to an awful lot of government oversight.
Well, that's true. Now, something's going on. What's going on in California? It's going to be the nation's first information privacy law for devices. What's happening there?
Yeah, we have a new law here dealing with the IoT, the Internet of Things. And brain implants, memory implants, are just part of that. Right now, we have peer-to-peer systems. But we're developing D2D systems, device-to-device systems. Everything will be talking to everything else. Your oven, your stove, your thermostat, that's already starting to happen. And the question is, how secure is that? And it's not very secure. In other words, the technology problems in making your stove smarter, whether it's through ordinary AI or fuzzy logic, those are kind of standard throughout the field, but it opens up a security problem that just wasn't there before. The landscape for hackers explodes exponentially here. The security problems. So California took the lead. Governor Jerry Brown, at the end of September, signed a law that will likely be challenged, no doubt, but goes into effect in a little over a year from now, January 1st, 2020. It's the first of its kind of any state. There's been some efforts in Congress to do that. And it requires of manufacturers of devices that can communicate with the Internet, which is just about everything, in California, to take, quote, reasonable security efforts to make sure there are dedicated passwords, for example, not just a generic password, and maybe some other efforts to improve the security. It's very vague, and as you know in the law, one of the ways to challenge a law is its vagueness. And that'll no doubt happen, but it's certainly the right kind of idea. And I think also, George, in this maximally partisan time politically, this is something our newly elected Congress might want to consider. That we really need guidance here, not necessarily laws, but we'll likely get those, but guidance from the Department of Commerce and then bills to convene a panel, put out some recommendations and standards so that device manufacturers can have some protocols to use to improve security, because they really don't have much now. And, for example, the government will likely require a certain level of protocol of security for anything that it purchases, and I think that'll be adopted by other states. But right now it's California in the lead on that.
Bart, why would somebody want to hack somebody's brain chip? What would they get out of it?
You know, you could just imagine the mischief that your son or little brother could cause with that, let alone someone you don't know, an enemy. But I remember, George, right before this election, how many robocalls I got trying to tell me to vote this way.
Oh,
or that
my
way.
God. It's on your cell phones.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if those robocallers could get inside your chip, they would do that in a heartbeat. I think that will follow like the night follows the day.
I'd go insane, wouldn't you?
That may be what it's like. I mean, you can imagine what would happen if somebody snatched your chip implant of your memory and said, look, George, if you don't pay this ransom, I'm going to noise out the last 3 years of your life, or worse, put in some kind of crazy memories that aren't accurate, and you won't be able to tell what you really experienced. You know, we just haven't thought this through. The technology is exploding in terms of the ability to do that, and there's no way to put the toothpaste back in the tube. But the potential downside here, certainly for your brain chip, but for any kind of household device, is very, very high, and we all need to be looking at that.
Would they be able to put in voices through chips? I mean, would you be able to hear, Bart, hey, Bart, what's going on, Bart?
You know, I guess they could do that if we had enough control. It's going to take a long time, 20 to 50 years, before you can really put that kind of substantive information. But the ability, I think the first thing you could do is harm rather than add a new voice, the ability to scramble what's in your brain. For example, how would you like to lose 20 IQ points unless you pay a certain sum to somebody in a jurisdiction outside the United States. It would be that kind of thing, I think, at first. And one can only imagine from there, let alone organized attacks like that in a cyber war or something done by a government.
They are using chips now in spinal cords, and people who have not walked in years are starting to walk again. That's amazing.
That is amazing, and there'll be a lot more of that as the finer neural engineering combines with the nano engineering. But again, just to take that case, you could create a bit of mathematical chaos in that neural at a key step, at a key neural junction, and the person would collapse. They could become paralyzed or could be put in a state of intense pain. And you'd say, why would someone do that? Why do these mass shooters do what they do? Why do people launch viruses? We just have a species. All I can say, George, in my office, I have a big wall chart of history for the last 10,000 years. I have all cultures. And it's in black and white, but it really should be in red because our species is a bloody, violent, aggressive species. And despite the advances in technology, I see no signs of that changing.
The great late baseball player Ted Williams has passed away. His family has his head in a cryogenic chamber, frozen, of course, deeply frozen, cryonics. And they are hoping one day to be able to download his memory that's in his frozen brain onto a chip and then download it back into a cloned body of Ted Williams. And hence, you have another great baseball player all over again. Is that realistic?
You know, it's a possibility. Now, I have to disclose that I sit on the science advisory board of Alcor.
Okay.
The leading cryonics outfit. That's
where he is, I think.
That's where, let's just say, potentially he is. and so I can't comment on Ted or any other patient's outcome. But I am signed up for that. And you might say, why? To me, it's what we call Pascal's wager. It's a version of that. Pascal said, look, should I believe in God? If there is a God, the payoff is big if I believe in him. If there isn't a God and I believe in him, no big deal. I might have wasted some Sundays or Saturdays, depending on my belief. But right now, in terms of dealing with death of the brain, there is no other method available, as bad as it is, for potentially backing up your brain than to suspend its structure in liquid nitrogen for however long it takes until you can have some kind of digital backup. The one thing about that, whatever the risks and hazards that are, and it's not that expensive, is that you have time on your side.
Yeah.
Essentially, once you're in suspension, not in a grave, not in a crematorium, once you're in suspension, you just don't care a year, a century, or a millennium.
Time means nothing to you.
That's right. Other than some slow quantum decay, there's really nothing changing. So we'll see. We like to think of that as a big experiment, George. And you and I are in different groups on this one. I'm in the experimental group. You're in the control group with about 7 billion other people.
That's right.
A couple thousand. And we'll let you know in a couple hundred years how it turns out.
All right. You might be on the show again with a clone me. You never know.
It could happen.
What about the possibilities with all this incredible technology that something could go awry? I mean, is it conceivable? I mean, I think we can clone people now, don't you?
We can do something in that direction. The CRISPR technology has greatly improved so we can at least shape some genes. And we're not yet able to directly program the genome, although I think that's clearly coming. But I think that's a matter of time.
What about some laboratory somewhere, Bart, where maybe they have cloned a person and they've just kept it quiet?
It's possible. It's certainly possible, and there could be problems with that, like there were with the Dolly sheep and the telomeres of the parent versus the child. But at some point, George, that is surely coming.
Other than our soul, and that's a different issue all by itself, the brain and the memory, that's who we are. So if you still have memory and you can put it into a clone body of yourself, you could put it into anything, and it should function. And if it does function, and if it does, you know, if you can make it workable, you literally can live forever with that memory, can't you?
You can live for a long time. It's an engineering approximation of that. But you're right, the brain houses synapses, these wires between the neurons. Just to give you a ballpark sense of that, there's about 100 billion neurons in your brain, about the same number of stars as there are in the Milky Way galaxy. And each one, on average, tends to connect about 10,000 other neurons. And that's an awful lot of connections in the brain. It has a processing rate, again because of ionic flow, of about a billion operations per second, which is just a little faster than the latest supercomputer, by the way, from IBM called the IBM Summit, which has 100 petaflops. But that's only going to increase. Now, the different kinds of operations. But there's no question neuroscientifically that memory is encoded in synapses. There's questions about exactly how it works. But we, in some cases, for example, the work of Professor Gary Lynch at the University of Irvine, California, you can see changes in the proteins of the synapses. So if you can model those synapses, back them up, or simply preserve them, for example, freeze them, but whatever method, then you have preserved the memory structure, the long-term memory structure, not the short-term.
Do we bring in the soul at all in terms of part of the argument of whether this works or not?
It's a hard argument because it depends on what you mean by the soul. But if you mean, as most of us mean, as that spark of life and intelligence, it's kind of like, George, the music that the brain plays. And the point here is that the brain's just a very crude musical instrument. We can play that music on something much more powerful, much more durable, and much faster. And that, I think, would be a kind of digital soul.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I don't think right now we would be able to transfer the so-called soul to a clone body. I think that clone body would probably have maybe its own soul, probably. But what do you mean by a digital soul now?
Well, consider that case. Like, go back to the original Frankenstein movie. They have the body and they stitch together, but they don't have the brain. We send out Igor, and of course he brings back the wrong brain.
Abnormal.
Exactly. But what if he brings back the correct brain? There's not a movie there, but that's kind of what we're talking about. So the idea would be, if you had a soul come back to life in the monster, it'd be the soul of the person whose brain you installed. Okay. And what if you partially backed up through a brain chip 1/100th of that brain? Okay, it still would be that person's soul. And then you could take another chunk. I call this in the book Heaven and a Chip in the novel Nanotime, chipping away at your brain. But we could, in principle, with that brain or with yours, while you're awake, remove a tiny chunk, figure out how it works, reinstall it with the chip, kind of like the experiment
right
that I just described, and you would never lose consciousness. And yet when we're done, you are now completely into a chip, and your brain's floating in some water in 100 different pieces. So that would be a way of, whatever you mean by a soul, of conveying it in real time without losing consciousness into a more durable medium of something still electrical like your brain, but something likely chip-based.
If your body is no more, yet they clone you and download memory, and so you are who you are again, are you dead? Is the original body dead, or the fact that you're in another body functioning keeps you alive technically? So do we physically die or not, even if that other body is no longer functioning?
George, I think you're putting a finger on it. We have to distinguish the questions, like we say in mathematics, of existence from uniqueness. Whether you exist anymore or once that brain is dead, the answer is no. But you could wake up. In some sense, you die when you fall asleep and you come back.
Exactly.
To life when you wake up or after a major surgical operation. The complication here is, what if you woke up in 100 different chips, and now you're existing, but you're no longer unique? We don't have a basis of reference for that in our experience, but that certainly would be possible with a digital soul.
Well, now you bring up something very fascinating, and that is, see, I'm thinking download your memory to one chip and then clone it to one body. You can make 100,000 of you.
Absolutely. And so we just talked about people calling up with robocalls. Maybe they're going to call up, George, and stick their digital soul into yours. And
that's...
indeed, not to promote my book, but that is one of the premises of the book Nanotime, that the villains in that book use that as a form of assassination, in effect.
And what do you mean by nanotime?
Nanotime is what it would be like to think in a chip. Right now, because we're made of meat, because we're made of very simple ionic flow devices, our signals travel, like from your brain to your big toe. Wiggling your big toe is a good exercise, by the way. About 100 miles per hour. Maybe 200 miles per hour. Not very fast. And as a consequence, we think at a very slow basis. But if you could back up the brain in the ways which we've just talked about, even with today's chips, you would think millions or billions of times faster, hence the word nanotime. so that a few seconds of right now, as you listen to me, could easily be a century in nanotime, a century in this kind of digital mind, and in fact, much more in with future computation. And what the concept explores, and I gave it the name nanotime, is the back and forth between our relatively slow, what we call meat time, common sense time, our sense of real time, and that very super fast. If you were in a chip, George, if you were thinking now in nanotime, everyone around you would be a statue of flesh, completely frozen. You'd be going so much faster. And this is one of the reasons so many of the popular sci-fi movies get it completely wrong. And they just haven't addressed what would happen if you had this kind of boosting. A sheer issue of computational speed.
That is amazing. Okay, we're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Bart Cusco. Don't go away.